From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. What an exciting morning we've had here at WDEO, and we would like to first start off and apologize for being a little late getting on the air, but somebody else, I guess, got into the control room and was who knows what was happening at the time. But it was, it's been an adventure.
Radio. That's live radio.
It's been an adventure, that's for sure. Yes, it's live radio. So we're going to have to kind of flip a couple of things around today. I want to make sure to let you know that we are going to be talking with Rob DuBois about his book entitled Powerful Peace, and Rob is in the studio with us, and I'm going to be bringing him on in just a little bit, and hopefully we can get a hold of our other guest, Captain Gerald Coffey, who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, and he's out in Hawaii, and we're having trouble waking him up this morning, which is understandable considering it's 3 o'clock in the morning there. But I do also want to talk a little bit about the program we did last week with Father Emil Capon. And as we told you last week, and for those of you that didn't get a chance to listen, you can go to our archives, veteransradio.net, and click onto the archives, and you'll be able to hear the whole story about Father Capon. And Bob Gould is here in the studio with me, and he produced the program last week, and I want to just talk about this briefly.
Go ahead. Fire away.
I was
inspired all week. Amazing.
I agree with you. You know, the more I talk to these men and women who have served overseas, the more I realize how important our missions were. Whatever time period we were in the service, it really does come back, and it's so important that we remember the lessons that we learned and that we continue on taking care of our fellow human beings.
Amen to that. Yes.
And anyway, I just want to remind people that President Obama awarded Medal of Honor to Korean War hero Father Emil Capon on, I think this was on the 12th, or the 11th it was, I'm sorry, just last week. And as I mentioned before, we talked about this inspiring story. And I wanted to read a little bit from the citation as soon as I can find it. Hold on here. This is, as I said, live radio. Here we go. Come on. Where did it go? Oh, here we are. Chaplain Emil Capon distinguished himself by acts of gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty while serving with the 3rd Battalion, 8th Cavalry Regiment, 1st Cav Division during combat operations against an armed enemy at Ulsan, Korea, from November 1st to 2nd, 1950. On November 1st, as Chinese Communist forces viciously attacked friendly elements, Chaplain Capon calmly walked through withering enemy fire in order to provide comfort and medical aid to his comrades and rescue friendly wounded from no man's land. Though the Americans successfully repelled the assault, they found themselves surrounded by the enemy. Facing annihilation, the able-bodied men were ordered to evacuate. However, Chaplain Capon, fully aware of his certain capture, elected to stay behind with the wounded. After the enemy succeeded in breaking through the defense in the early morning hours of November 2nd, Chaplain Capon continually made rounds as hand-to-hand combat ensued. As Chinese Communist forces approached the American position, Chaplain Capon noticed an injured Chinese officer amongst the wounded and convinced him to negotiate the safe surrender of the American forces. Shortly after his capture, Chaplain Capon, with complete disregard for his personal safety and unwavering resolve, bravely pushed aside an enemy soldier preparing to execute Sergeant First Class Herbert Miller. Not only did Chaplain Capon's gallantry save the life of Sergeant Miller, but also his unparalleled courage and leadership inspired all those present, including those who might have otherwise fled in panic, to remain and fight the enemy until captured. Chaplain Capon's extraordinary heroism and selflessness above and beyond the call of duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, the 3rd Battalion, 8th Cavalry Regiment, 1st Cavalry Division, and the United States Army. And receiving the Medal of Honor on behalf of his uncle was his nephew, Ray Capon.
You know, he only survived 6 months. That was it. That's how much sacrifice he made in his rations and water and his own comfort, safety.
You know, it's fascinating when you look at the strength of these people that were POWs, and I'm hoping that we can reconnect with Captain Coffey, because his story of capture in North Vietnam is very similar. the determination to stay alive, for one thing, the reestablishment of their faith, not only in human beings.
Did you read the book?
Oh, absolutely.
Was there a chaplain there in the?
No, they took care of themselves. They had to take care of themselves, and they were so isolated from each other, much, you know, unlike Chaplain Capone, they were separated, but they came up with this TAP system that you might have heard of, where it was kind of a abbreviated Morse code system so that the bad guys couldn't figure out what they were doing, and they were able to communicate throughout the compound with each other either by tapping on the wall or they would cough in a certain way, and people would – that was it's an amazing story, and I'm hoping that we can get him on before the end of the program today.
Well, that is a very interesting segue, as I like to say in the business. That is, from last week to this week.
Well, you know – we're not done with this segue. We're not done with the segue, because joining us in the studio right now is our guest for this morning, and this is a Rob Dubois. And Rob has written an amazing book in its own right called Powerful Peace. And, Rob, I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about yourself. But he is a former Navy SEAL. He has been around the world on missions that he can't tell us about, more than likely. And we're going to ask him to share the mission of his book and his mission currently. And so, Rob Dubois, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. It's great to be on.
It's been kind of a hectic morning, so we're going to just jump right into it. So tell me a little bit about your military background.
Well, as many readers know, I'm a hybrid. I spent 10 years in the Navy doing various works with various agencies as a Russian SME, before a subject matter expert, before I picked up the Navy SEAL career. I went to BUDS halfway through my career and became a SEAL. I went to SDV Team 1 in Hawaii for 7 years, and I spent most of those years in special reconnaissance, which means sneaking and peeping. Hiding under bushes and watching people do stuff, basically, is our mission. Of course, a lot of time in the SDV, or the SEAL Delivery Vehicle, our free-flooding mini-submarine. We float around underwater and go places in.
Really?
Then I retired after 3 years in D.C. as a virtual terrorist, running red cell work, emulating the enemy around the world to give our commanders better insights on what their vulnerabilities were so they could stop real terrorists from getting in.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were in Iraq. Where were you prior to 9/11?
Well, that's a very interesting story, because on 9/11 I was teaching Arab SEALs how to kill terrorists in their country in the Middle East. It was a Gulf country, and we were actually on the ground with the guys for a few weeks. On September 11th, we watched it happen live via satellite feed where we were. Of course, it was the evening on that Tuesday, September 11th. And so 10 Arab SEALs and 10 American SEALs sat around in a horseshoe shape watching the satellite feed as almost 20 Arab terrorists murdered 3,000 people.
What was that like? Because in your first chapter in your book, you talk about the emotional reality of sitting there with these, you know, Middle Eastern SEALs now and watching it together.
One section of the book is called Surreal and So Real. And that's we chose that deliberately, because it was a surreal experience, absolutely, to watch with allies and friends and guys who would have died beside me to stop what we were watching together. Mm-hmm. Was a unique and invaluable experience for me personally, to be able to take my message forward with Powerful Peace over the years. It's a real stake in the ground, if you will, to base what I'm trying to talk about with applying smart power, with the fact that we cannot simply approach every problem with the same tool, mm-hmm. that smart power, hard and soft power, that we use coercion and persuasion and attraction in equal and inappropriate amounts based on the situation, whether it's interpersonal with your family or international with other nations or other populations, in the sense of, you know, Al-Qaeda is not a state-run organization. It has mm-hmm. state support in some cases. But in fact, what I used that story in the front of the book. The first chapter is called Hate, and we talk about watching 9/11 happen live, because I want my readers, and I want many other folks who have heard the message around the world different ways, to understand that, you know, a lot of my Arab and Muslim friends understand, of course, that Arabs and Muslims are not terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorists sometimes call themselves Muslims. There's a very big difference. The same thing is true with Catholic terrorists or Jewish terrorists or atheist terrorists. And so what I want to convey with the idea about hate and talking about 9/11, surreal and so real, is that we are humans first, and it depends on where we come from and what we see as far as what we believe and choose to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking with Rob DuBois, who's the author of a new book entitled, well, I don't know how new it is, but it's a book entitled Powerful Peace. And if you have a question for Rob that you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. It's 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. So what motivated you to write Powerful Peace?
As a matter of fact, I began writing a blog called Powerful Peace. It's still, of course, up and running and is one of the cornerstones of our seal of peace consulting of today. I began writing a blog called Powerful Peace in 2008 from Baghdad, I think it was. And I wanted to get the idea out of to follow a column I'd been doing called For Goodness Sake, in a play on words for an editor out of my hometown around D.C. I was writing from Iraq for a few months on this column called For Goodness Sake because what my editor, Rob, who also is the editor of Powerful Peace, and I perceived, what he understood from my experience and talking to him in our hometown there, was that, again, back to the theme of humans are humans first, and cultural layers have a lot to do with where we end up and what we choose to do. And we ourselves, of course, you know, parents tell their kids, you are who you hang out with, so I'm going to watch who you're hanging out with. I don't want you to absorb the behaviors of your friends who are, you know, shoplifting, for example, or whatever the mischief may be they're up to. The fact is the same thing is true in adult relationships, and in fact, internationally, we have the way who we hang out with makes a big influence. Look at Syria today. Syria is a disaster. We were talking about before the show. It's a terrible mess, and it has a lot to do with who it's been hanging out with over the years, as far as where Syria is choosing to go these days, in terms of viciously abusing civilian lives. So I had written a piece back in the mid-2000s called Understanding for a U.S. agency, and the point of understanding was very much like the smart power concepts of Joe Nye, who is from Harvard and first wrote about soft power in 1990, or persuasion and attraction, the same form of power that attracted the Japanese to pick up baseball and poodle skirts after the war. It was never forced on them. It was simply a matter of an appealing cultural aspect of American life. The same thing is true in our own behavior, which is why I emphasize so strongly personal accountability. How I choose to walk my walk daily is going to be a message that's much louder than any number of words I spout to people over the days. So when I learned about smart power, and I realized I've been writing about smart power, there was an intersection, and so I started talking about Powerful Peace at the blog, and it grew up over several years. And in fact, a lot of the content of Powerful Peace is in the book today.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you say is the main message of Powerful Peace?
I've been trying to capture that. There's a way that we this is fun for your listeners. You actually get to see Powerful Peace evolving before your eyes. I'm starting to use an acronym of BREAD to keep an idea, to keep something in mind, a stake in the ground, if you will, mentally for folks to understand what it's about. But what I'm advocating in Powerful Peace is the acronym of BREAD, which starts with balance. Balance is ultimately the best way for any individual to make a difference in the world in an effective way. Because if we balance our body, mind, heart, and soul, the four aspects of human life as I'm describing it, we become more effective citizens, more effective family members. If we're not imbalanced as a bodybuilder who doesn't care anything about anybody else's cares, or an emotional superpower who cares nothing about developing his mind, or a spiritual guru who absolutely has no interest in the worldly things around him, those imbalanced characters are not very useful to society. So we start with balance, and respect is key. Respect is one of the biggest themes in Powerful Peace. If we have time during the program, I'll actually pull an excerpt out of the book about respect at Abu Ghraib, one of my lessons pick up at Abu Ghraib prison.
That would be important.
Empathy is key. Empathy is the point of being in relationship with other people, in my personal opinion. It doesn't mean being touchy-feely. It doesn't mean being a Casper Milquetoast who's so wringing his hands at every person's distress, but rather understanding where individuals are coming from is key to being functional with them, even if I'm trying to kill them. It doesn't matter that, you know, powerful peace is not about loving everybody into a state of submission. There are guys like we talk about in every presentation who may be willing, would be willing to walk into this studio right now and push a plunger on a lever in their hand to blow themselves up, to kill the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
That would happen right now if a guy, probably somebody listening to this right now, who would like to have access to us, could do so, he would do so. So in that case, the only option for an armed individual would be to shoot the guy in the face. You cannot stop a person like that with loving and talking and kumbaya.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases for hard power, for ultimate kinetic options. I advocate that all the time, and I advocate for a ruthless restraint. When we have the capacity to use violence to stop a worse violence, then we have an obligation to use it. We also, therefore, have an obligation to develop that capacity, which is why I'm an expert marksman and I'm a black belt and other ways I can break people, but I choose not to use that power, and that makes me more powerful in society, because if it's understood that I can, but mm-hmm. I choose not to, then there's a much greater respect evident. So that was a big diatribe on empathy in the destructive perspective. But obviously empathy gives people what Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey, talked about as being psychological air.
Mm-hmm.
When I listen to you with the intent to understand what you're saying, you don't feel rushed. You don't feel defensive. You don't feel like you have to force what you want to get across into my head, because I'm hearing it deliberately. That empathy makes me much more effective with other people. Accountability is the A of bread. Accountability is where we each responsibly say, you know what, I did do that thing. That was wrong. That was a messed up choice on my part, and I'm sorry for doing it. You know, standard, much less practiced than it should be in society, in my opinion, mm-hmm. Internationally as well. America is not a perfect country in the sense that we've never made a mistake. Just like I am not a perfect person in the sense that I've never made a mistake. In fact, I outdo myself on mistakes every day, I think. I'm very flawed, very human person. But I've learned through my own painful experience that when I choose to be accountable for said mistakes, when I choose to be responsible and give people the respect of apologizing or acknowledge my wrongdoing, it tends to strengthen relationships and not damage them further, which denial does. And finally, dignity. I talk about dignity and respect throughout the book, especially in two solid chapters describing dignity in one and respect in the other.
Mm-hmm.
And dignity is something that every human being requires. And I've seen indignation. I've seen people being treated without dignity in every nation. So it's close to respect. But respect, in my opinion, is much more a way of how we behave. Like I talked about at Abu Ghraib, I was taught a lesson in that in real time by one of the guards dealing with the prisoners. And in fact, respect is a way I behave every minute of my day when I'm speaking to somebody I like or don't like. It doesn't mean only a feeling like I'm in love with somebody. It's a feeling like it's a sense of doing what you choose to do respectfully.
Okay. We're gonna take a break here. Since our calendar clock is off a little bit, but we are going to take a break. We're going to be playing our Medal of Honor and then going through that. And we'll be coming back with Rob DuBois, and we're going to talk about that experiences that you gained from the Abu Ghraib thing. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Navy Captain James Stockdale inflicted a near-fatal wound to himself to show his willingness to die rather than divulge information. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Stockdale was recognized by the North Vietnamese as the leader in the prisoners of war resistance to interrogation and in their refusal to participate in propaganda exploitation. Sensing the start of another purge and aware that his earlier efforts at self-disfiguration to dissuade his captors from exploiting him for propaganda purposes had resulted in cruel and agonizing punishment, Stockdale resolved to make himself a symbol of resistance regardless of personal sacrifice. He deliberately inflicted a near-mortal wound to his person in order to convince his captors of his willingness to give up his life rather than capitulate. He was subsequently discovered and revived by the North Vietnamese, who, convinced of his indomitable spirit, abated in their employment of excessive harassment and torture toward all of the prisoners of war. Upon release from the captivity, he was promoted to Rear Admiral. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we were trying to play a little Anchors Away there for our guest, Navy SEAL Robert DuBois, who has written a powerful book, pardon the pun, entitled Powerful Peace. And we were just talking about some of the issues that you touched on, Robert, really important. By the way, if you want to get in on this conversation, you can give us a call here at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. And we're talking about how Rob's military experience has kind of morphed into this, I can't even describe it really, except that instead of using our power of might, let's use the power of our minds and figure out how that we can get along with people without having to necessarily shoot them all the time.
While ensuring that we maintain the capacity to shoot.
Right.
That's the key. It's a balanced approach, and it's based on the fact that we can use force if we need to, because nothing invites violence like weakness. That's
absolutely
the target.
Right.
That's exactly what the brute is looking for.
This kind of goes,
rapist,
goes all the way
the
back
brute,
to Teddy Roosevelt and,
right.
And you know, that sending the fleet around the world and carry the big stick. But, you know, we're not going to use this stick unless it's absolutely positively necessary.
Right, right.
But don't think that you can get away with stuff.
And that's a great example. Speaking of segues, what a perfect example of where we're going with powerful peace compared to the longstanding philosophy of walking softly and carrying a big stick. Walking softly in the world is something that I believe that is hard for some nations with dominant power to do. I don't mean that dominant nations like America are abusive necessarily. I mean, there are nations that are abusive, like Saddam Hussein. We talked about this right here in the book throughout. The book is the years I spent in Iraq. However, it is possible for a dominant power in a household or on the planet to be less than completely mindful of that person or nation's impact on others. We hear that a lot from our detractors around the world who say America deserved 9/11 in some cases. The most horrible thing we can hear is those who thought it was a proper comeuppance, a black eye on the great power that was ignorant of the ugly American, that was ignorant about the needs of the world. So the perspectives we have around the world are again, where what we believe and what we choose to do are driven by what we have observed, our experiences. So I do, if you will, go there on the Israel-Palestine issue. In the front of the book, I talk about that. I don't say I'm for X or Y, because I'm not. I'm for the children in Palestine and Israel being safe. That's what I'm for. I'm for having families not be torn apart on either side by any reason. I'm for letting people find the way to get to the common ground, find ways to dialogue in respectful discourse with, in some cases, ruthless restraint of the power they know they have behind them, but choose not to use it. So it's a balancing powers, applying smart power, using a full range of soft to hard power, persuasion to coercion. That is all based on being humble and having empathy and understanding what the needs are and what the perceptions are. And one of our, having done a lot of civil affairs support around the world, I've seen, where we, the superpower, if it was the coalition or the Americans in isolation, have made decisions and made choices that were with the greatest of intentions, which some say the road to hell is paved with. We, a great example of that is a well that was dug in Afghanistan, which was built by the Americans, cost a certain amount of money and time to build right, and it was with the intention, because the ladies had to walk something like 5 miles to get water every single day. They'd go to the river and they'd come back with the water. And we, in our isolation, decided it was a better thing for the ladies in the society. And of course, we're about empowering women, having equal rights between the genders is a huge part of having stability in any society. Having anybody be degraded or dominated by race or religion or gender is undermining to the success of that society. So what we try to do is support the women in a society where possible. And so the well was built. And when the builders came back sometime later, they found it kicked in. And they thought, well, how outrageous. You know, the Taliban were here and they destroyed this well, or whatever the assumptions were. They dug a little deeper and found out the ladies destroyed the well themselves because the ladies had no opportunity to talk to other ladies except for the 1 or 2 hour walk around trip to come with water. Every day they went to get the water and came back. Now, this is something that your standard WASP guy, military person, would not comprehend. It was a very important part of their life, was to be able to walk to get the water, to get away from the men for a few hours, and to do that part of their day. And so that was a great example of the best of intentions that were not fully comprehended. The empathy was not there, absolutely.
Well, we're learning slowly but surely that our way is not necessarily the right way. It's like people talking about, well, you know, they need to have a democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan that looks like ours, and we know it'll never look like ours.
Right.
Because, I mean, we're such an aberration when it comes to a democracy. When you think about all of the different ethnic groups that make up America and how we somehow get along, I don't know. But, you know, and then we look at the rest of the world, and the guy across the street doesn't like the guy on the other side of the street because he wears white and one wears blue or something, and that's going to go on forever. And we just can't fathom that. I think, you know, I liked what you were mentioning before about the respect and the empathy and so forth. And there was a speech I saw once, and this guy was talking about with just a little understanding, just a little caring, little empathy, we could get along a lot better.
Right.
Instead of judging people based on our own idea of what the world should be like, maybe we could, you know, maybe things could get a little bit quieter in the world, and maybe we could actually decide that, okay, we are going to take care of some other people who don't have the advantages that we do, and, you know, 800 years of authoritarian control. I mean, even just coming out of authoritarian control must be frightening.
It begins in the home, too. So much good. If people come out of broken homes, come out of unstable homes, if they're broken people, they don't have the ability to build stable societies and stable nations and stable international relations. We who are broken simply can repeat what we know. That's a simple fact about human upbringing. So where we can provide stability for homes, for families, for these villages or cities, wherever we're dealing with nation building, like you said, we can't build an American-style democracy. We can facilitate the general human desire for representative democracy, whatever form that may take. And that's one of the stomping points in Powerful Peace, is to say that it is absurd for any of, you know, we have been criticized for American arrogance. Well, one of the reasons that I support the idea that some have considered us arrogant based on, again, what they perceive compared to what we perceive as we're projecting, is that same thing about building a well where we don't understand what the purpose mm-hmm. is, what the fulcrum purpose is. And we do the same thing at a higher level nationally, and we may say that, you know, it would be good for Iraq to have Burger Kings and McDonald's. It would be great. And there are, of course, Burger Kings and McDonald's there. But it would be great for them to have what we have. Mm-hmm. And that is a simple error on thinking. It's the Iraqi culture is thousands of years old. Ours is a couple of centuries. Why in the world would we be so presumptuous as to say that Iraq should look like America? And most Americans don't say that. Most Americans mm-hmm. say we'd like to see a stable Iraq that has Iraqi values at its core, that appreciates human worth and dignity, and that is Iraq. It's a healthy Iraq, and that's by God's grace, but that's what I'm going to help develop as we keep fighting for this, you know, looking at each nation, each population having its chance to develop into its fullest, best, healthy self.
Okay. I only got 2 points I want to touch on here. Number one, you mentioned earlier that you wanted to talk about the respect issue at Abu Ghraib, and so you have a segment in the book that you want
Absolutely.
To read to us.
I visited Abu Ghraib back in 2004, 2005, following the scandal, which was not my fault. I like to advocate that right away. I was on a counterterrorism, anti-terrorism assessment where I would go and play a terrorist. I would attack U.S. bases for the purpose of finding vulnerabilities that the commander could build up against the actual okay. existent vulnerabilities. We had a number of successful predictions, if you will, of scenarios that might develop based on the existing vulnerabilities, and most of them were stopped because of the presence of my team having gone there and said, this is what we see. We're looking at it like terrorists. We don't want you getting attacked by insurgents or terrorists effectively, and here's what we recommend you do. And it was done many times. On one of these visits, I was talking to a guard at Abu Ghraib. I like to indict myself first whenever I have a chance. Back to the accountability mm-hmm. of breath. If we have a chance to identify something that we're not doing right, it's good for other people to hear it because it helps them be more honest about their own limitations. So swaggering in my cami uniform, rifle and trident, that's the SEAL insignia on our chest, I'd been looking out over the yard, enclosed in triple strand concertina wire, while we talked and staring at the detainees with self-righteous, angry suspicion. Which one had most recently killed one of my own friends? I asked this guard how he could stand to deal with these, in my words, scumbags. I just try to treat them all with respect, he replied. Some of these men were detained for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. They're innocent, but it'll take us several months to confirm that and return them to their families. He paused. It's hard here for a woman to try to run the house without her husband. I deflated a little. He continued, some are absolutely guilty. That guy over there, he pointed to a smallish, quiet, ordinary-looking individual walking alone in a dishdasher robe, killed 2 Americans in an ambush a few days ago. He's a hard case, and nobody else can work with him. But he's willing to talk with me and usually does what I ask. I think it's because I act respectfully toward him. I deflated the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. That anecdote from my personal life and my personal correction by circumstance, by being shown a better way, is one of the many infinite number of events that have occurred in my life that have taught me to behave respectfully and humbly and openly and with accountability whenever possible. Now, again, as I said, I fail every single day. But these are crucial lessons I've learned that I'm trying to share with everyone.
I this is an issue I want to talk about. We're going to take one more break right now to talk a little bit about the Marine Scholars. And then we'll be back. We're talking with Rob DuBois. His book is Powerful Peace. And again, if you want to get in on the conversation, we're coming up toward the top of the hour already. It's 877-573-7825. We'll be right back after this message. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Rob DuBois, whose book is entitled Powerful Peace, that you can find on Amazon and probably a number of other places. But I think it's really important for you to pay attention to what we're talking about today. And I think it's fascinating when we think about the respect that Rob is talking about with regards to other human beings. And this is kind of a theme that I find running through many of the books that we talk about here on Veterans Radio with veterans and what they have learned from their experience. And I know that right now, and I wanted to, we got about 10 minutes to go, I wanted to, you know, tell me, what are you doing right now? What are you doing in Michigan today?
Well, that's a great question.
Other than being on our program, of course.
Believe it or not, I'm doing almost everything. I've been in consult with, I came up to Michigan initially for a conference on faith and conflict we did over at Henry Ford, the university downtown in Detroit. I was invited there by a friend's wife who was coordinating this faith and conflict conference. When I got there, we began talking to law enforcement and youth and the local Islamic Center in Dearborn, which of course is the well known for, I won't say it's the primary Muslim population in the United States, but I believe it is.
It's the largest concentration of Muslims, I think, in the country.
So I met the imam there, who's well renowned. He was another, who was a fellow speaker at the conference. We had a chance to talk, and he introduced me to his director. So I'll be connecting over there at the Islamic Center when we can get the right venue, just to connect, because a lot of the book talks about my work with Muslims, of course. It's not a Muslim-centric book. It's not an anti-Muslim book. It's a simple fact that I have done a lot of work in a lot of countries that were Muslim-predominant, and I have been able to, if you will, represent that population among people who are more like me than I am like them, than I am like the folks I've worked with. So that extended into a conversation, a really good engagement with the commanding officer of a local very tough precinct in Detroit. We'll be working together and going forward on youth initiatives, trying to help out with kids, trying to help the kids in Detroit. It's a very, very difficult situation right now. The city is in a very hard place economically. I wrote a piece about that recently when I got to experience it for a week or so, and I began to live and breathe. My host, my sponsor, Kerry, he's a mentor for me, and he's a guy who lives downtown in one of the worst places. He chose to move downtown into one of the harder areas so that he could be, as an activist, active. Now, this is another WASP like me, a guy who doesn't have to live there but chooses to. So, we have to take all the appropriate precautions for living in a neighborhood like that. And down the street from there was a youth center. Got to do an appearance there the other day. People that can go to powerfulpeace.net and see the blog. Click at the top to see the blog. You'll see the article that I wrote about that event. The kids came swarming, kids of all colors, all backgrounds, from this very difficult area to grow up. I went and talked to them about the ideas, of course, at a children's level, 8 to 12-year-old level, about powerful peace, about dignity, respect, hope, promise, what they can look forward to, their potential, because I don't want kids to feel like they're stuck where they've always been is where they'll always will be. And right. It's not possible to know otherwise unless you're told by somebody.
Right, and somebody has to tell you those things. And it's not like I always want to go back 50 years, to the idyllic world of the 1950s, which we know were not as idyllic as we thought they were.
The
when
marketing
we were
campaign was idyllic.
But there are some things that we have to continually teach our children and other people that they seem to have forgotten. It was funny last night when I was perusing your book as best that I could. I went right back to the Boy Scouts. And I said, oh, yeah, I got to be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind,
obedient,
cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent.
Right.
And I said, now, that's not a bad motto to follow. If we could all just do that and respect each other, because we come from so many diverse backgrounds, really. The thing we've got going for us is that we're all able to live in a unified country somehow without you know, violence, excessive violence all over the place, you know, one group against another. And I think that that's something that we have to keep America to be aware of, that you should be proud and just so excited by this experiment that's been going on for over 200 years that it's still working.
Right.
And that with a little more effort on our parts, that we can help these children, we can help them rise up out of this poverty, and you got, if they just had some semblance of respect and dignity, as you mentioned earlier, I think, and I know that your book is full of these
yeah, it's all stories.
Points.
That's why we use the storytelling method.
And this is what we have to do with America's youth. We have to be welcoming to all of these different cultures that are out there, and maybe make a little more effort to find out what they're about.
Right.
Because really, everybody in the world really only wants a couple of things, and that's safety for their family, a roof over their head, and food.
Yes.
And to be left alone.
Beyond that, if you've got those basics, there's very little reason to rise up and squawk and cause a crisis. In fact, you know, grievance is the underlying component of any insurgency or terrorist activity. What I argue is that grievances are perceived. I think any of us can tell that. You know, you walk into the office and, you know, Bob and Dale are talking and somebody had a bad night, didn't sleep well.
Right.
Well, then he might be a little surly. And the other person can choose to interpret that one of many ways. Mm-hmm. One can be that guy's a real jerk. Yeah. But because you have a longstanding relationship, because relationship is the foundation of understanding, you know, you probably give the benefit of the doubt, saying hey, that's not like him. That's not how he would normally behave. So I think it's important that we understand that the more we can build said relationships, which means communication, which means dialogue, interfaith dialogue, intercultural dialogue, which is not a natural state for us. We tend, you know, birds of a feather flock together.
Mm-hmm. But I just think it's so important that if we can make that little extra effort to learn about these different groups. So maybe we can understand what their grievances might be.
Precisely.
And how
what the misunderstanding is.
Yes. What the big misunderstandings usually
end up
being.
There are huge misunderstandings. I'll give you a couple of examples. We had this is a hard topic, but I think it's a military channel. People can understand. Like they talked about the Medal of Honor a moment ago. One of my favorite anecdotes about misunderstanding is that an A-team, a Special Forces team I was working with, went in and took down a bad guy, captured him, got ready to leave. They had him zip-tied ready to leave in Iraq. And when they were leaving, the wife of the man told the interpreter with the team, the insurgents, she wouldn't use that word, of course. She called them the foreigners, the foreign men, which means the guys that came from other parts of Iraq or from other countries nearby. But she said what she had revealed was their message, their campaign, their information operations are constant. We're doing it right now. We're communicating. We're sharing information. There can be nefarious purposes behind it. All the way up to the dark side is called PSYOP or psychological operation, where we twist the truth and even lie sometimes. But most information is about sharing public relations. She said the foreign men told us that whenever the Americans came to get our husbands, they would rape the wife.
Mm-hmm.
And the interpreter said, Oh, and he told the captain leading this team and the young leader of the team, the A-team leader, said, tell the lady to tell all of her friends everything that happened, the whole truth. If we're too rough with her husband, if we broke her favorite lamp, tell them that and tell them what didn't happen, because that's important, because they'll believe her. Mm-hmm. But they won't believe us dropping leaflets from the sky saying Americans won't rape you.
Right.
We have to share that truth.
That's a similar propaganda method that's been used for years and years, is that the, you know, in our case, you know, the Americans are going to come in and just rape and pillage, you know, they think we're the Vikings.
Because it actually co-opts local men. If you're afraid that's going to happen to your wife, you might fight to resist when the Americans come into your house.
Absolutely.
Even though you're a florist or an economist of some kind, not an insurgent.
Whoa. You know, I'm sorry we didn't get to have a full hour to talk about this, and I'm sure that, Rob, we're going
to
have you back on the program sometime in the future to talk about the book. And let's quickly go. The book is Powerful Peace. Where can they get it?
Easiest, well, anywhere, literally anywhere you can get books, you can get Powerful Peace. Every version of soft copy exists. We have Nook, Kobe, Sony, iBooks, the whole deal, Kindle, of course. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the stores, the online sources, and at powerfulpeace.net.
Okay, it's powerfulpeace.net.
That's the only source for signed copies, is powerfulpeace.net.
Mm-hmm. But also you have your blog up there, and
That's right.
You also do some podcasting yourself.
That's right. We do a weekly thing called Power for Peace Radio, and in fact, a little sneak preview, just like I talked about the acronym we break out in Evolve Power for Peace. There's a Power for Peace video or TV coming up in the future, as well as study guides, as well as study groups, and we're just really growing rapidly. There are courses being built right now. In fact, my wife as an educator is helping build one to provide to schools, to walk them through the same curriculum that was done by my friend Jamie Poland in Kentucky a few months ago.
Okay, you mentioned that this is being offered to classrooms
exactly.
And schools around the country.
As an information process. The kids in Jamie's class came out of a Silver Week curriculum she'd built out of the manuscript, in fact, and she said that they told her they were changed people. They didn't care about skin color. They didn't care about background or nationality. Mm-hmm. They didn't care about boys and girls or the kid who's a little nerdy, you know, the kid that gets bullied a lot. They became bigger people, and their parents wrote Jamie letters. I'm going to go stop down and see them. I'm really excited about that. Monday, I get to see Barron County Schools, get to see Jamie and her, all the Peace Hawks, we call them, because they've helped us really break some serious ground in educating youth on powerful peace.
Okay. Well, Rob DuBois, thank you so much for being on Veterans Radio and filling in almost as much time as we did have. We'll be back next week talking about women in the military, hopefully, and going to get a hold of Captain Coffey if we can and get him back on at a future date. And I don't know what, Bob, what have you got going?
Well, we're going to be talking about Syria, definitely a very hot spot in the world. We're also going to be talking about North Korea. I'm hoping to get Dr. Rebecca Grant back on. We had started a series on North Korea and what will be the Air Force response to the threat.
So, okie dokie.
Coming up.
Check. Coming up on Veterans Radio.
Go to our website.
Check our website in the future. Send us your email if you want to get notified by us of what's going on in the world. Until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.